the Secretary of Agriculture, Mr. Tom Vilsack. Congratulations. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. Let me start off with an acknowledgement of the fact that I am a bit nervous as I speak today. I don't normally get nervous, but I'm nervous today because I realize the significance and importance of the group I'm talking to. So I thought about this speech. It occurred to me that in America, we have a tendency to focus on achievement. We just watched the Olympics. And for a couple of minutes, if you were a great downhill skier or you were a skater, in a matter of seconds, you were the best in the world, and you were given a gold medal. And you were able to come home and able to receive the adulation of your hometown community, and maybe you had a parade, and you probably have endorsements that will allow you to be comfortable for the rest of your life. And if you're in any kind of major league sports or in entertainment, and you reach the top of your game, they have a place called a Hall of Fame that you're placed in, and you're acknowledged for a lifetime of service. If you're in big business and you have a good year, you're rewarded with a huge bonus. And then I started thinking about American farmers. I mean, who are the people in this room? These are people who plant 240 million acres of our land. They are the most productive farmers in the world. They help to produce 108 billion pounds of protein a year that feed 300 million Americans and many, many millions around the world. In my lifetime, they've gone from feeding one out of every 20 people, one farmer to 20 folks, to today it's one farmer to 150 folks. They're responsible for a trade surplus at a time when our country talks only of trade deficits. But in agriculture, it's a trade surplus, $22.5 billion of surplus, the largest surplus we have in our trading efforts. Responsible for one out of every 12 jobs in America. Farm families and ranch families responsible for creating employment opportunities for people in urban and suburban areas all across this country and in rural areas. The work of the folks in this room and the farmers and ranchers around this country are responsible for the water that 100 million plus Americans consume every day. You folks are responsible for giving Americans an enormous advantage in terms of their incomes because only about 10% of family income is spent on food, whereas in most other countries it's 20% or 30% or 40%. That means Americans have far more discretionary income. The folks in this room are also responsible for creating a more energy-secure America. Instead of having to spend billions of dollars overseas to countries we don't like, we're now beginning the process of building an industry that will allow us to have energy security. And it is people in this room and people all across the country like you, when there is a disaster or a difficulty in some other part of the world, what is the first thing America provides? It's usually food produced by the people in this room. Given that, you would think there would be gold medals for all of you. You'd think we would all have ticker tape parades for farmers. You'd think there'd be a Hall of Fame for the 2.2 million of you that produce our food, fiber, fuel, and feed. And as been suggested earlier, you would think that there would be big bonuses associated with the farm community, but indeed that is not the case. You and I know it's not the case. You and I know that in farm families across the country that only 11% of net family farm income comes from the farming operation. We know that nearly one-half of all the farmers in this country are required to work not just on the farm 24/7, 365 days a year, but they're also required to have off-farm income in order to keep the farm. We know that in the course of my lifetime, we've seen fewer and fewer farmers. When I was born in 1950, 15% of America's population were farmers. Today, it's less than 1%. Just in the last 5 years, we've lost 40,000 producers in production agriculture. And we know that the age of farmers continues to go the wrong direction, with 30% increase in the number of farmers over the age of 75 and a 20% decrease in the number of farmers under the age of 25. And not only is this impact in farming, but we're also seeing it in rural America, a place with higher poverty rates and higher unemployment rates than the rest of the country, a place where we're seeing population declines in the vast majority of our counties, an aging population, a less educated workforce, finding it difficult for you and for people like you to be able to turn to their sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters and say with conviction, there is real opportunity here. So tonight, today, in this location, I want to talk to you about rural America and the fight for rural America that we all are engaged in. And I want to suggest to you that it is an important fight for this country because it isn't just about the economic connection that rural America has. It isn't about the food and the fuel and the fiber, all of which is extraordinarily important. It is about the value system that defines this country. Because you see, even though we only represent one out of every six Americans, in rural America, 45% of the folks who serve us in uniform come from rural communities. Now, why is that? Now, some might suggest it's because people sense there's better opportunity there, but I don't think it's that reason. I think it's because the people in this room and people like you all across America have conveyed a sense of responsibility and duty to each succeeding generation, that it isn't just about yourself or your family, or even your community, it's also about your country. I believe rural America is the heart and the soul and the guts of America. And I believe that we have to start paying real attention to our farm families and to those who live in rural America if we want to preserve that value system. So it's important for us to figure out new strategies and different strategies and expanded strategies for bringing prosperity back to the farm, prosperity back to the ranch, and prosperity back to rural communities. And it starts with an appreciation for what you do for us. Affordable, abundant food that allows us to do all the other jobs we do. The economic opportunities you create for one out of every 12 workers. The surpluses that you create in trade that allow us to create wealth in this country. So I think I'm speaking to a lot of gold medal winners here today. And that's why I'm a little nervous, because I want to be able to convey to you how strongly I feel about this fight. Now, it starts with two simple strategies. It's pretty clear that in order for us to bring prosperity back to rural America in a meaningful, significant way, we first of all have to start by expanding market opportunities. We have to focus on expanding markets domestically, and we also have to focus on expanding markets globally. And I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about both of those opportunities. We also have to focus on continuing to expand rural opportunity for those who don't necessarily work on a farm, but who wish to be part of rural America. It will require both. In order for us to expand trade globally, I think we have to think differently about trade. In the past, we've thought about individual countries, and we've basically approached trade with a one-size-fits-all approach. The President has announced the National Export Initiative, which has charged the USDA with beginning to think strategically about trade. We will clearly advocate on behalf of free trade agreements. We want to see an expansion of free trade in Korea, in Colombia, and Panama, because we know that will increase opportunities for farm families. But we have to do more than that. We also know the importance of multilateral discussions, the Trans-Pacific discussion that takes place, the negotiations in Doha that are so important to make sure that we have a fair and balanced agreement. All of that is important. But we have to begin realizing that not every country that we discuss trade with is in the same position. So I want to talk to you about a continuum that we will now put in place, a new strategy, a new approach. It will recognize that there are different markets depending upon where we are in the globe, who we're talking to, different strategies for different markets. There will be strategies for fragile states, states like Afghanistan, where we're engaged and involved in trying to help build a stable economy, not because we expect trade opportunities to occur today, but because we expect and hope that trade opportunities will occur in the future. There will be countries where we will see tremendous growth potential because they are small countries, but they have moderate growth. They are continuing to expand their opportunities. Countries like South Africa, for example, where we need to approach and develop more market potential. We need to put resources into those countries that allow them to understand the significance and importance of quality of the American brand, of regardless of whatever commodity we're trying to trade. We also have to recognize and be aware of the fact that there are countries that either implicitly or explicitly create barriers to our trade. And so we have to work hard to create the technical expertise that allows us to go into those countries and begin tearing down those barriers. Begin talking about the fact that those barriers aren't based on science or aren't based on any kind of rule. And also at the same time build in that country a distribution system that will create a domestic incentive for trade with America, partnerships and alliances in restricted market areas. We also have to deal with those economies that are growing rapidly, those markets where there is a rising middle class that presents tremendous opportunities, but those are countries like China that often put sanitary and phytosanitary regulations in place that do not necessarily comport with science or rules-based systems. And so we have to continue the process of breaking down those barriers, continuing to send technical teams, as we just did this week to Russia. And I'm pleased to announce that as a result of the conversations with the Russians, we finally reopened the pork industry in Russia, reopened the pork opportunities for American pork. We still have teams over there today discussing, and we'll probably discuss during the weekend, on trying to reopen the poultry industry. We continue to work with China on the export certificate to reopen the pork market in China. We continue to work with technical experience and expertise to break down those sanitary and phytosanitary barriers that are being constructed in those emerging high-growth potential areas. And we also have to reflect and appreciate the fact that there are markets that are quite mature, where there is a real demand for higher value-added products that requires a slightly different approach, a recognition that we're engaged in stiff competition with other countries for that potential and that opportunity. So we have to put resources in that country to build the capacity of the American brand to be promoted so market share can be increased. It's one of the reasons why we have proposed a significant increase in the budget submitted to Congress for our cooperator program to work with commodity groups in places like Japan to continue to open up opportunities, continue to develop relationships and alliances. This market strategy reflects a reflection and understanding of the sophistication that now takes place in trade. One size does not fit all, and it's important for us to tailor our approach in trade to the individual market conditions we find, and we're prepared to do that. We need to do one other thing in trade. We need to focus on the need for expansion and a better understanding of biotechnology and a greater acceptance of biotechnology. Now, I realize that there are a lot of folks domestically that have concerns about this, but I will tell you this, and you all know this. The reality in the world today is that the population of the world continues to grow, and the amount of land available to produce farm products, to raise food and fiber and fuel, continues to shrink as communities expand and develop around the world. We have got to use science in a significant and important way to increase productivity. Biotechnology has that opportunity. I recently gave a eulogy for Norman Borlaug when he passed away last year, and I did research on his early life. The father of the Green Revolution believed very, very clearly that this was one way of dealing with the issue of ever-increasing world population and how you would feed that population, the use of science. And what I found out from his early life is a lesson I think a lot of Americans have forgotten. And that is that we didn't always necessarily have the kind of productive agriculture we have today. There was a day not long ago in the lifetime of people who are still living in this country where we had subsistence farming where if we didn't grow, we didn't eat. And I think we have become too distant from the producers of our food and fiber, and we fail to realize how difficult it has been and continues to be to put that abundant food on our plate. Norman Borlaug understood that, and he understood that science was a way of dealing with this challenge that we had, and doing it in a way that wasn't harmful to the environment, that uses less chemicals and pesticides, that becomes more resilient to climate change. Science cannot be denied. But we have got to do a better job of promoting that science, of making sure people understand the benefits associated with that science, of building relationships through public diplomacy, farmer to farmer, government official to government official, talking about the importance of biotechnology, developing international relationships and organizations that can help promote this, developing alliances with other countries and other parts of the world so they can help amplify our message. We need a concerted approach in biotechnology. And we've put this strategy together. So when you combine a new approach focused on markets with a continuation of efforts to promote biotechnology, with additional resources focused on technical experience and working with cooperators, you've got a new momentum for trade. Combined with the need for expanded opportunities in countries like Korea and Colombia and Panama and others, the President has charged us with increasing our trade opportunities. He's charged all of the economy with doubling our trade exports in the next 5 years. And it may seem like a tall task, but just understand that 10 years ago, the trade, ag trade, was roughly $50 billion. Today it's $100 billion. So in a decade, we have increased and doubled trade opportunities. But if that's all we do, it won't be enough. We've got to focus on our domestic markets as well. And I want to talk to you about the importance of the biofuels industry and the significant role that that can play in helping to reshape and rebuild a stronger, more vibrant economy. A recent report from the bio folks has suggested the economic impact of biotechnology. The economic impact of using that and biofuels to produce new opportunity. Consider these numbers. That in the year 2022, in just 12 years, if we meet the thresholds established in our renewable fuel standard law, 190,000 people will be employed in the biofuels industry. 190,000 people. In fact, if you leverage all the indirect jobs that will be created from this industry being more robust, it'll be closer to 807,000 jobs. $95 billion in the next 12 years will be invested in the expansion of the biofuels industry, $95 billion. It will have in that year a $34 billion annual impact on the economy. The total impact, when you take into consideration all the direct and indirect benefits, almost $150 billion. And most importantly at all, it will allow us to prevent having to import $350 billion of foreign oil. This is an amazing opportunity for us. But what has been lacking has been a strategy for the development of this industry. The President tasked us with putting together a biofuels task force report that outlines how we're going to approach the next 12 years. We're going to set mileposts to make sure that we are making progress every year to growing this industry. We're going to make sure that it is a national industry, not just focused in one particular area, one particular region, or one particular feedstock. There are enormous opportunities here in all parts of the country. Enormous opportunities for farmers and ranchers. Enormous opportunities for rural America. And there needs to be a concerted effort in growing and expanding this industry. That's part of the strategy of USDA. So we're putting resources behind this, and we're using our rural development resources to help build these refineries. We're using our energy title of the Farm Bill to promote payments to farmers for feedstocks, to help build refineries, to retrofit existing refineries, to put people to work in rural communities. Now, there are a number of other strategies that are involved in expanding markets, including better linkage between local consumption and local production, making sure that people locally know what's being grown, and the schools and the hospitals and the institutional purchasers of food look first to their local community and their local farmers to see whether or not supply can be satisfied, building smaller processing facilities, smaller warehousing facilities, smaller slaughter facilities so that we have a local economy that is supported and linked to agriculture. It's precisely what we're trying to do with Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, is to build that kind of local infrastructure. All of that is key and important to reconnecting people with their food. And building alliances between our farm families and people in the country. Because as we see a shrinkage of the number of farmers and we see a shrinkage of rural populations, I will tell you what will happen is that we're going to continue to see, if this continues, a shrinkage of the political impact of rural America because of reapportionment and the redesign of new legislative districts. So it's going to be important for us to have allies, important for us to for people to understand precisely what you all do, how important you are to the future of this country. And that's part of what USDA is about, is helping to build those alliances and those connections so that people understand what you do and understand what USDA does. If we can build alliances with folks in the nutrition area and a better understanding on their part of what you all do, they might be there to help us rebuild rural America. If we can build alliances with our hunting and fishing and outdoor recreation friends by the use of our conservation programs to create more habitat, we can help build alliances that strengthen the opportunity for rural America to be rebuilt. This is an important period of time and a threshold period of time for us to do this. We also have to focus on rural development and the ability to build businesses and small businesses that surround our farmlands and our farm fields and our ranches so that off-farm incomes, income opportunities are available. And we have decided to focus on regional development, on expanding broadband, on developing a series of strategies within rural development to create more job opportunities. We have got to be able to provide better-paying jobs in rural America if we want to rebuild it. And if you expand broadband, for example, if you invest in that technology, you allow small businesses that are located in rural communities to be able to expand their markets beyond the local market they currently serve to a global market. It's one of the reasons why the Recovery and Reinvestment Act provided for $2.5 billion of investment in broadband expansion. It also will provide farmers and ranchers in remote areas with information, real-time information, so you can make better market decisions. All of this is part of a strategy of helping to rebuild rural America. Now, I want to finish with why this is so important. Earlier, I alluded to the fact that 45% of the people in uniform come from rural America. When I was a governor, I had a lot of responsibilities. But one of the most important responsibilities I had was as Commander-in-Chief of the National Guard. It became a very significant responsibility when we went to war because our National Guard was called and called often. Unfortunately, some of those folks we sent to Iraq and Afghanistan did not come back. And my responsibility was to reach out to families to express condolences. Hardest job I ever did. I want to share with you one story because I think it says a lot about rural America and why this fight's so important to me and why it's important to you and why it's important to the country. The call I will always remember as long as I live was a call that I made to a woman by the name of Aliva Smith. Aliva was married to Bruce Smith, and Bruce was in his 40s. He'd been in the National Guard for 20-plus years. He was the guy that the young fellas would always go to for advice. He was a helicopter pilot. And he was called by his country for a third tour of duty overseas. He said goodbye to his wife and his two beautiful children in his small town, West Liberty, Iowa. And he went halfway around the world to a very dangerous place called Baghdad. And while he was in Baghdad, his job was to ferry troops from one neighborhood to another because it wasn't safe to drive through those neighborhoods because of those explosive devices. I've been over there, so I have a sense of how dangerous it was. On one occasion, Bruce was flying his helicopter with a number of folks on board, and his helicopter was hit with a handheld missile. And as he dealt with the tragedy of this chopper going down, he and his co-pilot had a quick decision to make whether they could try to maneuver that chopper in such a way with what little they had left so that they would maybe save some folks on board or maybe put themselves at risk, or whether they would potentially save themselves and put the folks on board at greater risk. Well, nobody would have ever known that decision if Bruce had decided to try to save his own life. But he did what he was taught to do. He did what you would expect him to do. He put his own life at greater risk than that of his co-pilot, and he and his co-pilot died that day, but 17 people lived. And I had to call his wife. And I picked up the phone, and I hoped that maybe she wasn't there, because I didn't know what to say to her. She answered the phone, and I started talking about thoughts and prayers and sacrifice and duty and all the things you would expect a person in my circumstance to say. But I fumbled around, and finally this poor woman rescued me by saying, "You know, I have this figured out." I thought that was kind of odd. She had it figured out. She said, "Yeah, the way I have it figured out, Bruce needed those 17 men needed Bruce more in that split second than I'll need him the rest of my life." I realized then, and as I realize today, I've been in the presence of greatness. It's the greatness that defines rural America and this country. Bruce was from a small town, and he understood that there was something worth fighting for and something worth dying for. And he was willing to put his life at risk because he understood that was his responsibility, that was his duty, that's what he was taught, that was his value system. And his wife understood that sometimes you have to sacrifice. And sometimes, unfairly, you're called upon to sacrifice far more than others. But that's okay, because you realize that you're sacrificing for something bigger, much, much bigger than yourself. Folks, that value system defines rural America. It defines your families and the values that you've taught your sons and daughters and your grandsons and granddaughters. It is that value system, in addition to your economic survival, that is at risk if this country doesn't start paying attention to the decline of rural America and doesn't start focusing and investing resources and effort to rebuild it. It is why trade is important. It is why domestic markets are important. It's why the biofuels industry is important. It's why broadband is important. It's why local food production is important, because these are all strategies to help build vitality and prosperity back. And so that it empowers each and every one of you to do what I know you want to be able to do, to turn to that son or daughter, that grandson and granddaughter, and say, "You can make a difference in your life with your life right here. You need not go anyplace else if you choose. You can have quality of life. You can make a contribution to your country. You can have the satisfaction of knowing that you're helping others be employed and being well fed, and that you can be able to respond to emergencies around the world with what you do, because it's valuable, it's important, it's significant, it is worthwhile, and it ought to be appreciated by every single American." And so, on behalf of those Americans who may not understand and appreciate what you do every day, who haven't said thank you, let me leave you simply with a thank you from the bottom of my heart for what you do. You have made this country, you continue to make this country, and I hope that we together can fight for rural America and make sure that people all across this country understand what's at stake. Thank you very much.